This is The Guardian.
Today, as the Supreme Court considers two landmark cases, American abortion rights hang in the balance.
Roe versus Wade is a case that defined abortion rights in the United States.
Any discussion of reproductive rights in the US takes you right back to one Supreme Court decision in 1973 that changed the course of history for generations of American women.
It was named for Jane Roe, a woman in Texas who was seeking an abortion, and Henry Wade, who was the district attorney of Dallas County, Texas. So in 1970, when this case was initiated, abortion was criminalized in the state of Texas. And Jane Roe, that was not her real name. Her real name was Norma McCorvey, but she was seeking an abortion. Eventually, the case made its way to the Supreme Court. And the decision laid out the idea that women can seek an abortion. They can seek to terminate a pregnancy in the privacy of a doctor's office up to the point that a fetus can survive outside the womb, which is generally regarded as 22 to 24 weeks gestation. A full-term pregnancy is 39 weeks.
Guardian U.S. health reporter Jessica Glenzer has been covering the fight over abortion. And she says the rights American women have taken for granted for nearly 50 years are now in jeopardy.
Since 1973, Roe versus Wade has provided the fundamental protection to women and pregnant people across the United States to terminate a pregnancy up to roughly 24 weeks gestation. And now there's two cases before the Supreme Court that fundamentally threaten that right, and one in which Texas has already effectively banned abortion within its borders. So we're at a really perilous moment for reproductive rights in the United States.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments in one of two key cases that could decide the future of Roe versus Wade. And abortion providers will be watching closely.
You know, for my whole career, upwards of 30 years now, people have always been talking about Roe v. Wade and whether Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned or whether it was going to fall. Abortion has existed for centuries. Now, people can have safe abortion from highly trained professionals since Roe v. Wade in this country, but you can close clinics and you can ban abortion at whatever gestation, but the same amount of people still need access to safe abortion in Texas and in this country.
We know what happens when pregnant people can't safely access abortions. They're forced to have a child when they're not ready, or they risk dangerous procedures which can lead to infections, infertility, and even death. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, could this be the moment that American women lose their right to an abortion? Jessica Glenzer, you're a senior health reporter at The Guardian US, and you've been covering abortion rights for years. The US Supreme Court is weighing up two big challenges to abortion rights right now, one out of Texas and one from Mississippi. I want to start with that Mississippi case because it is being heard today. Can you tell me about that first?
First of all, the case is called Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. It's named for Dr. Thomas Dobbs, the health commissioner in the state of Mississippi, and Jackson Women's Health Organization, the state's last abortion clinic, which sometimes goes by the nickname the Pink House because you can imagine it is a pink stucco house in Jackson, Mississippi. The case is about whether the state of Mississippi can ban abortion at 15 weeks. That's 9 weeks earlier than the right currently enshrined by Roe versus Wade. And the reason that this is so important is because it strikes at the heart of the idea behind Roe versus Wade that a woman has a right to terminate a pregnancy until a fetus can survive outside the womb or viability. Mississippi's ban is before viability. And the reason it's so widely watched is because the Supreme Court could have easily not taken the case. It could have dismissed it, deemed it unconstitutional and not heard oral arguments. The fact that it did take the case implies that there's at least four justices who believe there's a reason to revisit Roe versus Wade. So it's an incredibly important case that could have national implications.
So what will happen at the Supreme Court today?
Today, the Supreme Court's going to hear oral arguments in this very important case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. And they're going to hear from attorneys for the state of Mississippi. And then they will hear from attorneys from the Jackson Women's Health Organization who will argue that Roe versus Wade should be upheld. The state of Mississippi has already filed a brief saying the court should take this moment to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Gosh.
And let's not forget that this ruling, whatever it may be, is going to come down just a few months before the midterm elections for Congress. So it's going to have a lot of political implications for especially the Republican Party, which has pushed anti-abortion laws for decades.
And if Roe versus Wade is overturned, how quickly could we see states restrict abortion?
Well, several states already have what's called a trigger law. So that's a law that says if Roe versus Wade is overturned, this state will automatically ban abortion. More states have a political makeup that makes it likely or extremely likely that they would move to ban abortion very quickly. And even more states have what proponents would describe as heartbeat bills. Those are laws that ban abortion at roughly 6 weeks. That's before the vast majority of women know they are pregnant. So those effectively ban 90% of abortions. So it's a mixed bag, but what is clear is that in the states that are hostile to abortion, there's 40 million women of reproductive age living there who would be immediately impacted. And I think it's easy to forget that before Roe versus Wade, there were septic abortion wards in every big city hospital in the United States. And that was a place where women, desperate to end their pregnancies, would be treated for injuries and infections that occurred from attempted abortions. And many of those women died in septic abortion wards. So we would find ourselves in another version of a public health disaster that is entirely preventable.
And Jessica, as someone who has followed this issue closely for a long time, part of the reason why we're talking about this now is because the composition of the Supreme Court changed a lot during Trump's presidency. Is there any indication of how the court will come down on this?
So there's 9 justices on the Supreme Court, 6 of whom are considered right-leaning and 3 of whom are considered liberal. There's now a conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court. Now, in this case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, it's believed that the 3 liberals will vote as a block to uphold Roe versus Wade. And it's possible that Chief Justice John Roberts could vote with the liberals because he's made some indications in the past that he's interested in upholding precedent and settled law more than rewriting that law. And then the question becomes, where are the other 5 justices going to land, the conservative justices? It's incredibly difficult to predict how the Supreme Court is going to rule in a given case. And they've surprised observers in the past. For example, in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a 1992 case, many people believe the Supreme Court could overturn Roe versus Wade there. So there is still potential for Roe versus Wade to survive this challenge, although it is an incredibly delicate situation.
What about in terms of the timeline of expecting that decision? Will it be in a few weeks or a few months?
So we're going to hear oral arguments today, and then we won't know the decision until June 2022. And the Supreme Court releases these decisions sort of at its own pace. It doesn't pre-announce the decisions in June. It simply announces every day the outcome of a few cases.
Jessica, what you've told me sounds like a potentially devastating development for abortion rights advocates. And that's just one of the 2 cases the Supreme Court is looking at. Before we get to the other case, the one from Texas, I have to say that following this from overseas, one of the things that's really hard to get your head around is that all of the polling shows that most people support some degree of abortion rights, but that all of the political energy, all the momentum seems to be going in the other direction. How did the US get to this point?
It's a great question. I mean, I think if you go back to the moment when abortion became a political issue in the United States, it's really telling because it wasn't 1973. Roe versus Wade was not an especially controversial decision at the time that it was decided. It was decided 7-2, right? Mm. Most justices believed that women had a right to terminate a pregnancy.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus, the anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional.
And it wasn't until 1978, the midterm elections during President Jimmy Carter's term,
the 78 vote,
that you started to see Republicans take up abortion as a political issue and begin to organize evangelical Christians around this idea.
He lifted man's ethics to the highest plane and demanded that we live that kind of a life.
Evangelical Christians stayed out of the political fray for many years, and it was when Republican operatives were able to bring evangelical Christians into the fold of the Republican Party that abortion became an issue around which they could unite conservative voters.
What single issue could say more about a society's values than the degree of respect shown for human life at its most vulnerable, human life still unborn?
Since then, they were able to build momentum through the 1990s as abortion clinics were bombed and abortion doctors were assassinated.
Just minutes after 52-year-old Dr. Barnett Slepian and his wife returned home from synagogue, a sniper shot one bullet from a high-powered rifle into their home, killing the doctor.
Through the 2000s, as we had debates around birth control and sex education in school and welfare reform. And then most recently, through the 2010s, in the Tea Party Republican movement that was really colored by what's come to be called Christian nationalism here in the United States.
And remember, it is one battle at a time, and we are winning. Because there are those yet unborn who are depending on us to keep the battle going.
It's a sort of Christian schema of belief in the political system that abortion should be illegal, gay marriage should not be allowed, and that really has a lot of nativist tendencies. And that's where you start to see Donald Trump come into the picture.
And we know that in his presidency, at least, Donald Trump was vociferously anti-abortion. He was the first president to attend a March for Life rally, and he appointed not one or two, but three conservative justices onto the Supreme Court while he was in office. What effect do you think this has had on the anti-abortion movement and the prospects for a case like this?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, President Trump, before he was anti-abortion, he was pro-choice for many years.
I'm very pro-choice. I hate the concept of abortion. I hate it. I hate everything it stands for. I cringe when I listen to people debating the subject. But you still, I just believe in choice.
And in the time that was leading up to his presidency and his campaign in 2016, he totally changed his stance on this issue and was saying he would be the most pro-life president ever.
Well, I'm pro-life, and I have
been
pro-life.
What does that mean to you?
Well, it means it's an issue. I mean, it is an issue, and it's a strong issue.
Most anti-abortion president ever, and he would appoint justices who would, quote unquote, automatically overturn Roe versus Wade. And he went into his presidency with an open Supreme Court seat and then was able to appoint two more justices. And this is the first abortion case they're hearing. So it's impossible to say exactly how this might shake out among this new court. But the fear is that these justices were vetted for their stance on Roe versus Wade, that it's believed that they oppose abortion rights, and that they may use this case to accomplish that goal, to overturn the legal precedent that's become the fundamental pillar of reproductive rights in the United States. And I think it's important to note here, too, that it also took nearly 50 years of inaction from Congress to bring this moment to a head. There was decades of opportunity for Congress to enshrine in law a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy, and they never did so because the issue became increasingly controversial through those decades.
So just to be clear, legislators could have actually set out a specific law ensuring the right to an abortion, but they didn't. So now it's just a matter of how justices interpret the Constitution.
Absolutely. And you can see this play out at the state level, too. So some states have affirmatively passed laws that provide a right to terminate a pregnancy. Many more states have done the opposite and tried to restrict abortion. But there was a moment when Congress could have enshrined this right in law, and instead it was simply left to the Supreme Court and to this case, which was seen as strong enough.
So that's the Mississippi case, which the Supreme Court is hearing today. Meanwhile, in Texas, abortion has already been effectively banned, and that Texas law is also being considered by the Supreme Court. Can you tell me what's going on there and what makes the Texas case different from what we're seeing in Mississippi?
Yes. So in what might be the second most watched case in the Supreme Court, Texas is before the Supreme Court for a separate law called Senate Bill 8 or SB 8. And SB 8 is a so-called heartbeat bill. But what it really does in effect is ban abortion at roughly 6 weeks. So what has happened is Texas wrote this law in such a way as to make it incredibly difficult to challenge in the courts. Texas took the unusual step of allowing private citizens to enforce its abortion ban against anybody who, and I'm using air quotes here, aids or abets a woman in terminating a pregnancy. So feasibly, this could be anybody from a cab driver to a clergy member to an abortion provider. It allows anyone, anywhere in Texas to sue someone who helps a woman. So that means the person doesn't need to have a connection to this abortion in any way. And if they succeed in their lawsuit, then they can get a $10,000 reward and their attorney's fees paid. There's no such provision for the defendant. So roughly 90% of abortions in Texas have been halted since September 2021.
So let me get this straight. It's not actually the state that's upholding this law. And what makes it so unusual is that you've got ordinary citizens who are enforcing this abortion ban on each other.
A lot of people have described Texas's law as a law based on vigilante justice. So a law based on the idea that you should rat out your neighbor for doing something that the state says is illegal. And in Texas, that has led to a climate of fear for women seeking abortions. For abortion clinics, it's led to a situation where they're questioning whether callers are trying to catch them out or if it's someone who's genuinely seeking an abortion. It's led to thousands of women going to neighboring states to seek safe and legal abortions. And frankly, to a lot of distress and suffering.
Working in abortion care is one of the most rewarding professions I think someone could have. We really just have a palpable sense of helping people realize their future and realize their dreams.
Amy Hagstrom-Miller is the founder and CEO of Whole Women's Health, a network of abortion clinics in Texas. She's been on the front lines of the abortion fight since the 90s, helping thousands of women access abortions.
Working in abortion, it was actually my first job out of college. I started when I was 21 and started as a front office staff person and learned every job in the clinic from assisting the physicians to counseling to administration. And I really am drawn to the work because of the sort of stigma and shame that is oftentimes perpetuated around sexuality in general, but is specifically targeted towards people who face an unplanned pregnancy. One thing surprising people say is that it's the best healthcare they've ever experienced. We have the ability to talk to people about their feelings and their beliefs and their health and their aftercare. And we've had many patients tell us because of my abortion with Whole Women's Health, I was able to be the parent that I wanted to be later in my life, or I was able to finished school. So the stories really, really abound about their experience in the clinic.
And so over the last few years, I think it's fair to say that the anti-abortion movement has gained ground in the US, and the rhetoric coming from politicians has become harsher. How has that affected how activists behave outside your clinics or on social media?
Good question. So unfortunately, the sort of version of domestic terrorism that abortion providers in the US have experienced has been going on for decades. These folks are much beyond the parameters of free speech. They have really violent rhetoric. They oftentimes are breaking what people think of as small laws, like trespassing or stalking or noise ordinances, etc. And they can be egged on and emboldened by certain people out in leadership in either government or sort of talk show host kind of people.
Yeah.
And so these folks have been incredibly emboldened during the Trump administration. Anti-abortion protesters, it's not the only issue that a lot of those folks are pretty fired up about. And we saw protesters in Washington, D.C. on January 6th at the insurrection, literally. We saw the same people on the video. And I think it's not lost on any of us that work in abortion care that many of the people who oppose our work are also misogynist. Oftentimes they're, you know, can be narrow-minded and racist, classist, et cetera. A lot of their language outside the clinic focuses on those issues as a way to try to, you know, offend the patients and stir the pot. And I think they've become less, I don't know how to describe it, but like, they don't mark their words. They're not afraid of letting out some horrible, hateful language.
It's a pretty scary picture that you paint. I just wonder, listening to that, if you've ever actually felt frightened or like a target.
Sure. You know, I think that's one of the strategies that anti-abortion folks use. And I think it's just riddled all over in this new legislation. It sort of sets them up to be vigilante bounty hunters. And, you know, they've been targeting abortion providers like that for years in this country. Friends who've had their wanted posters or they're being stalked on the internet, et cetera. And I think it's important to kind of flip that narrative and realize that the vast majority of people in this country support access to safe abortion, that these people might be loud and they might have power, but they surely don't represent the majority, not in the country, but also not even in Texas. So that's kind of what keeps me going, is just kind of knowing that those folks don't represent the majority.
So those anti-abortion protesters must have been pretty pleased when this new vigilante law came into effect at midnight on September the 1st. What was the atmosphere like at your clinics? Did they turn up?
Our clinics have protesters on the regular basis. And on this day, they were very charged, energized. I mean, this is a victory, according to them. And so they came out in full force and were there all day, observing the staff and surveilling the staff. The protesters called the police twice and the fire department once, trying to come up with ways to stop us from seeing all those patients. Then once night fell, they went and got these big lights and put them on the sidewalk to illuminate the parking lot in the clinic, basically just to be sure they could watch our every move and really kind of, you know, made it very clear that they were watching and that they knew midnight was coming.
And what were you feeling when it got to midnight?
I think for the staff who are working in the clinic at that moment, it's just really absurd to be there on one day when you can say yes and the next day when you can say no, when your commitment as a staff person and your training and expertise is no different from one day to the next. It's awful to have to turn people away when you're perfectly capable and trained to take care of them.
What's it been like at your clinic since then?
So we are still open. We are providing abortions to the legal limit, the new legal limit, I should say, in the state of Texas. And we are also helping people by giving them ultrasounds and good information and counsel for what they can do if they are over that point in their pregnancy. Most patients are just stunned. They're just shocked. Many of our patients can't even entertain the idea of traveling outside of Texas, either because of their immigration status or because of their economic status. Most of our patients, almost 80%, are parenting already, and they're juggling jobs and schools and kids' childcare, et cetera. And so many of the patients are trying to figure out if I am forced to continue a pregnancy against my will, what's that going to mean for my life? And do you think you can overturn this law? Should I just wait and see? And there's a lot of heartbreaking conversations that our staff are having. And most people are leaving without a plan because they just can't even believe it.
Coming up, how these American cases could have a global impact. Jessica, in the last few decades, a lot of countries around the world have liberalized their laws on abortion, like Ireland, like Mexico and Argentina. And people think of abortion rights as something that generally move in a linear fashion. But as these challenges in the US show, that's not quite the case. What implications could these cases have on abortion rights, not just in the US, but around the world?
Well, I want to say, first of all, that as you alluded to, what many of us see as a march toward progress is not necessarily always going to move forward. That's what I have learned from the debate over abortion in the United States, that it's the actions of individuals that are going to influence how our society is in the future and the rights that we have in the future. So I think that that's something that could happen in any country, not just in the United States. In terms of the immediate international ramifications, should the Supreme Court decide to overturn Roe versus Wade, this precedent doesn't just stay in the United States, and it's a potentially catastrophic situation in the view of the United Nations Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Dr. Tlaleng Mofokeng, which is why she's written a brief to the Supreme Court saying that not only is this a human right, the right to terminate a pregnancy, but also that the United States would then find itself in violation of human rights conventions that it's a party to, for example, the Convention Against Torture. Because as Dr. Mofokeng argues, it is torture for a woman to carry a pregnancy to term against her will.
And if that gets overturned, it has catastrophic implications, not just for the United States. We have this joke among us that when the US sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold, right?
It becomes something cited by anti-abortion, anti-women's rights, and authoritarian courts and leaders all over the world.
So if that does happen, if Roe versus Wade is weakened, which is a legal change that was unthinkable for a generation, how will the reproductive rights movement respond? And what's the legal situation? Can it be challenged outside of the Supreme Court through legislation?
So states who want to protect the right to abortion could pass laws in their individual states codifying that right. However, in order to ensure the right to abortion for all women, the Supreme Court would either need to uphold Roe versus Wade or issue a judgment that is in favor of abortion rights, or Congress would need to pass a law that affirmatively gives women the right to terminate a pregnancy. It would be an immediate crisis for the Biden administration if Roe versus Wade was overturned. It would really be incredibly tumultuous if it happened. In terms of attempting to provide women abortions, there's a whole other scenario that happens there where people would be fundraising to help provide travel and lodging and potentially abortion medication to women in southern states. But in terms of winning that right back, it's really difficult to predict.
Gosh. Jessica, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
That was Jessica Glenzer. My thanks to her and Amy Hagstrom-Miller. You can read Jessica's piece, What Will US's Future Look Like If Abortion Becomes a Crime Again? And follow the latest updates from the Supreme Court at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef, Hannah Moore, Alice Fordham, and Eva Krisiak. Sound design is by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Mythili Rao, Archie Bland, and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.